Blog Talk Radio.
Lay your hands on the radio. Lay your hands on the radio, band of home.
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Blog Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Canada
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can't handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. Ms. Ansel is under attack seems like the universe, although she wrote a very detailed rebuttal to the smears Andrew Breitbart and by extension Glenn Beck are using against her. We'll deal with that in a little bit once I get my email up. In the meantime, stay tuned. I'm going to put on something by Professor Alfred McCoy. I've been playing this throughout the week, and if you miss it, I'd like you to listen into it. It only runs about 10 minutes, and it's from Tom Dispatch, another fine website. We'll get back to Consortium News after this.
TomDispatch.com. This is TomCast. Interviews and insight from Tom Dispatch contributors for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of our post 9/11 world and a clear sense of how our global imperial system actually works. I'm Timothy McBain. This week I had the pleasure of speaking again with Al McCoy, a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin Madison and author most recently of the award winning book Policing America's Empire: The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. We spoke about how empires are maintained, why the U.S. empire is in decline, and what the consequences might be depending on how we deal with that decline. In your article, you used the term subordinate elites, where a lot of people might simply say puppet dictators. Why did you choose that particular term?
First of all, it has a venerable lineage going back about 200 years. The British Empire, at its peak in the late 19th century, ruled directly and indirectly nearly half of humanity. Its formal colonial empire covered a quarter of the globe, and its informal empire of, if you will, kind of client states in places like China, Persia, and much of Latin America, covered another quarter of humanity. There was no way that a small island of 40 million people with an army of just 99,000 men could control 800 million people. And so how did the British Empire expand? How did it manage to maintain something akin to global order for the better part of a century with this tiny army of 99,000 men? The answer very simply was that they rested on subordinate elites. Now, in the former colonial empire, this meant that basically at the district level or kind of the county level in the British Empire, you'd have British imperial governors and district officers dealing with an amazing array of local notables, ranging from chiefs, traditional chiefs in the Fiji Islands, through sultans in the Malay Peninsula, maharajas in a third of India, and emirs and chiefs all across Africa. And then in the informal empire, they dealt with emperors in the Ottoman Empire, emperors in China, emirs in the Middle East, and then presidents in Latin America all the way from Buenos Aires to Caracas. So when the British Empire ended in the 1950s, and then the Cold War came, and suddenly the Eisenhower administration was confronted with taking responsibility for, you know, half of the world that wasn't behind the Iron Curtain, they defaulted to almost exactly the same system. And what they worked out very quickly was that they would have a diverse array of leaders, military autocrats, dictators in Latin America for the most part, a mixture of dictators and democrats in Asia. And then in the Middle East, they used the same British preference for aristocrats. And so we had a Shah in Iran and emirs in the Gulf and kings in Libya and Egypt and Morocco. And so it was an amazingly diverse system, and that remains the system today. That's the system that we've seen exposed in the WikiLeaks cable.
I was wondering if you could talk about one of the tools the U.S. has used over the years to control foreign countries without having to resort to direct involvement, which is what is now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, but is better known by its former name, the School of the Americas.
Well, sure. The School of the Americas was basically a school for training Latin American elites. Now, normally, at the height of the Cold War, the purpose was, of course, to improve their military administration. What it also did was to build intimate personal ties between the trainers, American officers, and these rising, very talented Latin American military officers who were selected for training at the School of Americas, primarily because they were seen as kind of comers, people that were going to rise to the command of the military hierarchy and who could serve as a kind of fallback, a default, an alternative subordinate elite should the civilian government turn insubordinate or incompetent. And that was a system, by the way, that throughout the Cold War, and even up to the present day, the United States has used. I mean, we've developed a very elaborate system for the cultivation, installation, maintenance, and replacement of these subordinate elites. And the most critical and controversial part of this process was the replacement. And throughout the Cold War, the Soviet KGB worked through its satellite security agencies like the Stasi in East Germany or the Securitate in Romania to keep an eye on their subordinate elites, the leaders of the 14 nations behind the Iron Curtain. On our side of the Iron Curtain, we relied upon the CIA, British MI6, and French intelligence, Eshtek, to keep an eye on the subordinate elites on our side of the Iron Curtain. And some of the most controversial incidents throughout the 40 years of the Cold War involved the coups by which the CIA would change a subordinate elite, an insubordinate elite, into a subordinated and subject ruler. So, for example, in Iran in 1953, when the Mossadegh administration was nationalizing oil and challenging the British-American dominion, the CIA organized a coup that replaced Mossadegh with a general, General Zahedi, who then gave way to the Shah. And in Indonesia, when Sukarno began to dally with Beijing, broke out of the UN, severed relations with the United States, and formed the Beijing-Jakarta Nuclear Alliance, the CIA helped maneuver the situation, which created a coup, a counter-coup, and a bloodbath that left 1 million people dead, and a reliable military ally, General Suharto, in power. And so it was in Chile when General Pinochet, replaced Allende in that coup, in which the CIA also played a role in backing and supporting the Chilean military. Each of these incidents, of course, were extraordinarily violent, tremendously disrupted, and enormously controversial, and cost the U.S. a great deal of prestige internationally, because the world very quickly realized that we were involved. And so you might ask, why did we risk such a blow to U.S. prestige by infringing upon the sovereignty of these nations in a time when newly emerging nations were very sensitive about sovereignty? And I would answer that it comes down to the critical importance of having reliable subordinate elites in power. And that's where we saw that, you know, although the United States is, you know, deeply committed to democracy across the world, nonetheless, in the Middle East, when the demonstrators began massing in Tahrir Square, that Washington dithered. You know, they didn't want to back away from Mubarak, because for 30 years he had been our loyal subordinate elite in a very strategic state in the Middle East. And so we came to that Democratic Party very late, and of course we came to it in a way that American officers contacted the Egyptian military and persuaded them to accept a peaceful transition beyond Mubarak to, guess what, military rule. But one of the things I think that emerges in the WikiLeaks cables very clearly is that as U.S. preeminence in the world has declined, our relative role in world trade has fallen, there are now rival centers to the economic and diplomatic influence of the United States. We get the rise of the so-called BRICS states, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. We also have the development of corporations who are transnational organizations, not attached to any single nation anymore. And so Washington's power has been diffused, and as Washington's power has declined, our subordinate elites have become increasingly insubordinate, increasingly intractable. And it's become extremely difficult for us to both change and maintain the system of elites. I mean, in 2002, the Bush administration backed a coup in Venezuela against its bete noire, Hugo Chavez. Well, that coup lasted a day and failed, and Chavez got back in power and is still in power. In 2008, the Bush administration tried to get the Chavez-Kosygin government in Georgia detached from Soviet dominion. Well, the Soviet Army intervened, Washington couldn't respond, and it was a disaster. In 2009, we tried to back the opposition in Iran to oust Ahmadinejad with an opposition victory. Well, that too failed. So WikiLeaks reveals the fine grain of U.S. diplomacy, showing that despite the acumen, the industry, the energy of our diplomats overseas, their capacity to control this system of subordinate elites is fading. And as that capacity fades, U.S. power, the U.S. empire, if you will, is on the wane.
You do say in your article that the decline of a great power is often a fitful, painful, drawn-out affair. However, many empires like the British have gone through that and come out pretty well on the other side. With the decline of the American empire, where do you see us ending up?
Well, this is something I've done in a project over the last 6 years. We've had something called the Empires in Transition Project, and I've been one of the principals in organizing 140 scholars on four continents to look at this process, both the rise and decline of empires. And when you turn to the decline of a half dozen of the European overseas empires between roughly 1947 and 1974, a very tumultuous quarter century, what you find is that those nations that planned and managed their imperial recession or their imperial retreat did rather well. Portugal decided after four centuries as an imperial power that they would simply wind it up, and so they did, and they did it in good order in Angola, Mozambique, and the U.S. got involved with Indonesia and East Timor, so that didn't go so well. But from Portugal's perspective, you know, it was a clean exit. Similarly, the British, with a few exceptions, brutal counterinsurgency in Malaysia and a terrible counterinsurgency in Kenya, with those two exceptions, they withdrew from the quarter of the world that they had colonized in pretty good order. And they managed their turnover of many of their assets to the United States, so that the City of London, British cultural influence through the medium of English, which was one of the chief legacies and artifacts of their empire, the residual role of the British military and British intelligence were preserved. It was a managed transition. But those states, like Spain and France, that tried to hang on to power when their time was clearly over, found themselves mired in terrible counterinsurgencies that ramified back at home, produced military coups, brought Franco to power in Spain, assassination attempts against President de Gaulle in France, that these were very painful, unplanned transitions that did tremendous damage to both societies. And looking at the United States, I don't see us planning for a withdrawal or the transition to a multipolar world. I see us trying to basically cling to power. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think, are the signs of a power that is fading and that is, you know, engaging in a kind of flailing, compensatory military operation in a desperate bid to show the world that we've still got it, the raw military power. And, of course, that is not working, and it's only accelerating our decline. So I think it's going to be painful. I think it's going to be a painful withdrawal. Moreover, we're not planning fiscally for that withdrawal either. We've got $4 trillion in treasury notes parked in central banks around the world. The value of the U.S. dollar is going to fall very markedly in the near future. The dollar will probably in the near future, as Paul Volcker, economic advisor to the president, has predicted, that the days of the dollar as the world's global reserve currency are pretty numbered. And that means that the cost of our credit overseas is going to go up. So we've got some hard times ahead.
Read Al McCoy and Brett Riley's article, Washington on the Rocks, An Empire of Autocrats, Aristocrats, and Thugs Begins to Totter. Please visit tomdispatch.com. There you will also find a link to find out more about Al McCoy's latest book, Policing America's Empire. I'm Timothy McBain, and until we meet again, thanks for listening.
From beach. There are the darkness you were meaning to keep under the covers. Now it stains your sheets of a bed you were claiming but not expecting to sleep in. From the ground, soaking in to your feet, all of the darkness you weren't expecting to reach. Your red-handed fingers and oily dreams, now you're suffocating. Blackbirds and beaches, fool me once, fool me twice, you're still selling me blood and rolling my dice, kill me once. I've only got so much to gamble.
Trump for president. What a hoot! I'll tell you a bit about Donnie today on Hightower Radio. This is beyond fabulous. It is exquisite. Donnie Trump, the flaming ego with feral hair, is drumming up a presidential run for himself. Just when you thought the GOP primary could not get any cheesier, what with Newt Gingrich, Michelle Bachmann, and others issuing sanity-curdling nonsense in a right-wing panderfest, along comes the Donald. The TV impresario and real estate huckster says that he's the man for 2012 because he has the background to run our government like a business. Whoa, Donnie, it's not nice to threaten voters. It is true that he has run several businesses right into the ground. Trump started in business right out of college with nothing but a dream, a driving ambition, and his daddy's multimillion-dollar real estate empire. He quickly turned daddy's fortune into a small one. Then he turned that into the first of his bankruptcies. But with a real talent for hype, he was able to get enough capital from Wall Street speculators, subsidies from government, and secret settlements from financial regulators to paper over his business incompetencies and improprieties. Just 2 years ago, Trump's casino operation went bankrupt, and he was tossed off its board of directors. Still, though, he has The Apprentice, his unreal reality TV show. So while Trump is not a successful businessman by a long shot, he does play one on television. And now, he wants you to help him take his cheesy act to the White House. How cheesy is he? The Donald has joined the Newt and Michelle B. in a panderfest conspiracy competition to see which one can be the most clownish in labeling Obama as a Muslim who was born in Kenya. This is Jim Hightower saying, Trump recently declared, I'm their worst nightmare. He was referring to the Obama campaign, but he's really America's worst nightmare.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
And we'll do one more, Hightower, and I hope Bob Perry is getting this and he'll call in, because I'm having a little trouble with my satellite uplink, as usual. It's on the blank. It goes in and out. So, Bob, if you're listening, Mr. Perry, you'll need to call in. Area code, and by the way, for listeners, area code, here's the call-in number for questions with Mr. Perry. Area code 646-716-8652. And here's another one from Hightower on the Tea Party. Both are pertinent, germane with what I want to talk with Mr. Perry about today. Both Donald Trump, who I guess made a big thing about the birthers movement, got the birthers going crazy, and the Tea Party with Hightower. This is Hightower on the Tea Party.
Weren't the new Tea Party lawmakers going to change business as usual in Congress? I'll tell you what happened today on Hightower Radio. They came, they saw, they conquered. This line pretty well sums up a little reported but important story about the new Tea Partiers in the U.S. House of Representatives. No sooner had they arrived than the corporate lobbying corps came to visit, saw what these supposed rebels were made of, and quickly conquered them without a fight. The forces of big business needed only to lay out some campaign cash, and quicker than you can say business as usual, the budding lawmakers snatched up the money and immediately began carrying the lobbyist corporate agenda. Check out the Financial Service Subcommittee, which handles legislation affecting Wall Street bankers. Five Tea Partiers got coveted slots on this panel, and all five were suddenly showered with big donations from such financial lobbying interests as Goldman Sachs. Now, all five are sponsoring bills to undo parts of the recent reforms to rein in Wall Street excesses. Steve Strivers of Ohio, for example, hauled in nearly $100,000 in just his first 2 months in office, 85% of it from the special interests his committee oversees. He insists that the cash he took from Goldman Sachs and others has nothing to do with his subsequent support of bills that Goldman is lobbying so strongly for. Stivers claims that his sole legislative focus is on jobs for Ohio's 15th district. Really? Among the Deform the Reform bills that Steve is carrying is one to let Wall Street giants avoid disclosing the difference in what the CEO is paid and what average employees make. Another would exempt billionaire private equity hucksters from regulation. I can see that these bills are great job extenders for the barons of Wall Street, but how do they create a single job in his district? This is Jim Hightower saying, this stuff does nothing but shelter the greed-headed banksters who wrecked our economy. Is that what the Tea Party Rebellion was all about?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
That's right. You'll hear Jim Hightower on weeknights. I played him up because I haven't been playing Jim Jim's stuff for months, really. But because of the, we're starting more programming. For your information, we come on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday evenings at 10 p.m. Central Daylight Savings Time. And then we go on Saturday, today, high noon, and Sunday, 3 to 5 p.m. We call it Secular Sunday. And we've got some great stuff coming. People sending in stuff, suggestions, and I'll do some programming notes. We'll see if Bob Perry will call in here. If not, I will have to do some finagling with my faulty satellite uplink connection right now that we're having right now. But programming right now coming up this May, let's see, next Saturday high noon. Yes, that's correct. Saturday high noon will be Stan Cox. Now, Stan Cox is from Kansas, works out in Saline at the Land Institute, and he'll be talking. He'll be coming on to talk on Radio Free Kansas about his latest book, Losing Our Cool. It's about air conditioning and the learning to not use air conditioning, learning to cut back on your energy bills by doing so. He's got some great tips on that. Plus, he's a accomplished writer, obviously. He has two books, Sixth Planet, which I've had on my all my blogs for over the last 2 years since it came out, and this latest one, Losing Our Cool, came out just a few months ago, and he is going to be talking about that and some interesting articles he's posted recently on Counterpunch. And he'll be on May 7th, I believe, and then on May 15th on Sunday, May 15th, on our Secular Sunday episode of Radio Free Kansas, we will have the big lawman, Vincent Bugliosi, on his latest book, Divinity of Doubt, The God Question, a perfectly appropriate one, which is his latest book. It's really just literally on the newsstands. Bugliosi is, you may remember him as the guy that did Helter Skelter years ago with the, it's published by Vanguard Press. And Helter Skelter is the one that blew the cover off Charlie Manson. It was this description. Bugliosi will be on May 15th, Sunday, on Radio Free Kansas Live. And I'm going to see if I can get my email to work to call Bob Perry, or maybe he'll call me. Either way, I'll play a song and I'll get right with you. See if he can get a hold of me. I think he's there.
Hello?
Let me see. Yeah. Mr.
Mike?
Perry?
How are you doing?
Yes, sir. Fine. Well, I'm having this Kansas, brother. It's Canada. That satellite uplink went on the blink 30 minutes before programming time. But listeners, here's Bob Perry. How are you doing, Mr. Perry?
Pretty good.
Thank you for coming on and taking your time off of the weekend to come on. I've been really closely monitoring what's been going up. I noticed on Consortium News today, you've got a you've got some great lineup of writers. And I've noticed, of course, Ray McGovern. Listeners, you're familiar with Ray McGovern. He's been on several times on Radio Free Kansas. And it's been a great pleasure having him on. He's a regular contributor, and I notice his articles appear first at your site, Consortium
right.
News.
Yeah, we sort of, Ray writes them, and I go through them, and then we go back and forth a bit, and then we put them up.
Well, it's great to get it there first. And listeners, that's where you get him. Ray's a senior CIA analyst, retired, and he is actually really a leader in the anti-war movement, if you ask me.
And you just get it from a rare insight. His latest is called Petraeus, A Threat to CIA Analysis. And I encourage it was just posted April 28th, and I encourage you to go there to Consortium News and check it out. He, Mr. McGovern really writes in depth from an insider's point of view, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think one of the nice things that we've been able to do is to make these connections to people, not just in journalism, of course, where I come from, but also people who had fairly senior government positions at different times.
Mm-hmm.
And get their insights, their firsthand insights. And in the case of Ray, of course, is probably the person we deal with the most. And he's been very good about providing that point of view from the rank and file analyst. Because it's at CIA, there are two parts of CIA. One is the more controversial part, the operations side, which most people think of, you know, the spying and the dirty tricks and the paramilitary operations, et cetera. But there's also what really is perhaps the more important side, at least when it was first set up, President Truman considered it the most important side, and that's the analytical division, which its job is to provide honest, straightforward information and analysis to the president and to top officials of the government so they can make decisions based on reality, not on fiction. And that had a great tradition going back through the years, and when Ray became a CIA analyst in the 60s, that really still was their tradition to sort of give the to tell it without the bark on, or with the bark on, as they would say, and mm-hmm. and whether the president wanted to hear it or not, and that was still their traditions going into the 80s, and one of the things that happened under Ronald Reagan was this politicization of the CIA analytical division, because it was understood that if the agency said, hold it, that's not the case on something that the president wanted to do, it could make it harder for the president to do it. So the approach that the Reagan folks implemented was to break down that objectivity and seriousness of academic almost seriousness of the CIA and replace it with kind of a careerist mentality. And there's been this struggle between the two, those two forces over the years. And clearly under George W. Bush, we saw the careerists turning over pretty much whatever the president wanted to hear on Iraq, for instance. And then there was a bit of a, and that's when Ray and some of the older, the guys who had left CIA, they were now retirees, but they sort of organized this group, an extraordinary group of intelligence veterans for sanity, or veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, and they began to essentially challenge this politicized intelligence that was coming out of the agency, and they had an effect where they would sort of help buck up the professionals at CIA to be a little more honest and stand up to the presidents. And what Ray wrote about this past week was now with General Petraeus being tapped to go over to run the CIA, there's an additional risk that here you have a general who is closely connected to these two controversial military situations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's going to put a lot of pressure on the CIA analysts to speak the truth again, because Petraeus isn't going to want to hear that the wars have gone badly after he was so much a part of conducting them. So again, we have another problem facing that part of the CIA, and Ray addresses that. It's a point that's been widely ignored in the press. Most of the journalists have looked at this in the context of the CIA doing more paramilitary operations, and that would sort of fit with Petraeus. But they've ignored this other side, which is, will Petraeus want intelligence that will make him look good? Plus, Petraeus also has a very close relationship with some of the leading neoconservatives who have been part and parcel of this pollution of the CIA and of information in general in Washington. We know from both what people have said who worked with Petraeus, but also from this extraordinary leak that he that he created for himself, where he was at one point trying to get the neocons to back him when he'd given some testimony, formal testimony in writing to a Senate panel that had included some mild criticism of Israel, and he was very concerned that when people started praising him for that, that would make him look bad with his friends on the neoconservative side. So he went running off to one of the top neocons, Max Boot, and began sending these emails saying, "Gee, how can you help me? How can you sort of head off this concern? You know, well, should I mention how I'm hosting Elie Wiesel at some event?" And he was like in this panic mode. And basically Boot said, "Oh, no, don't worry, I'll sort of put out something." So Boot put out a blog entry saying that Petraeus is a good guy, he really didn't mean this, and this criticism of Israel. And Petraeus thanks him and says, "Roger," and he does like on a sideway happy face, you know, they can make those with like colons and, you know, right. In that parenthesis. Anyway, and then he sends this off. And then when someone had written to Petraeus and said, "Gee, you know," someone was praising Petraeus for these comments he'd made, which Petraeus was backing away from. Petraeus then sent an email with Max Boot's commentary. But Petraeus forgot that all this other stuff was at the bottom of it, and so the whole thing went. And so this guy gets this thing with his, you know, Petraeus saying, "Gee, read Max Boot's column; it'll straighten things out." But he also had in there all this back and forth about, "Gee, would you please help me out with this sideway happy face," and so forth. So we know that Petraeus has this very cozy relationship with the neocons. And the neocons have been famous for trying to distort the whole intelligence product when it's on an issue they care about.
Well, this is one of the things I like about your site, because it really is a lot of nuances from the inside of the Washington Beltway. That's one of the great things about Consortium News. And I always catch Ray McGovern's stuff because he writes, he doesn't write, listeners, he doesn't just write a few paragraphs. This isn't a news blurb or you don't get any of these news blurbs or comments, just fireballs hurled out to incite or agitate. That's more my speed. But with Consortium, where it is, and all my neighbors know that. But the thing is that I go to Consortium News for the facts and really get the inside, what's the nuances that are going on. They're extremely valuable. Now, that's sort of the East Coast stuff. You can go to Counterpunch, of course, but, you know, you're going to get there a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of different writers, and I like Alexander Coburn's Counterpunch. I look for it. But there is, in my opinion, some more real serious reader stuff there at Consortium News, where you can really go. I wanted to run down some of your writers you've been publishing. Now, this is an interesting guy. I've read everything that Reverend Howard Bess, I think B-E-S-S, listeners, and he is a very unusual guy. I guess he's originally out of Alaska or something. Am I right or wrong about it?
No, he's based in Alaska, yeah. He grew up elsewhere, but he's now retired. He's living in Alaska. It's true.
And it gives you a whole, Reverend Howard Bess gives you a whole new perspective on Christianity, which I find very important for Kansas listeners out here. We've got a lot of problems in mixing our religion with our politics and mixing the politics with religion and mixing our business and religion, and I think it's a problem. But Reverend Howard Bess gives a great perspective on Christianity from a point of view that I don't think any Kansans understand, or if they do, they're keeping their mouth shut, because it's a very merciful writing for Christianity. And could you tell us how he came to you, to Consortium News?
Well, I think he was a friend of a friend. There was a woman that writes for his, once in a while, Barbara Capel, very good writer and an investigative reporter. And she knew Reverend Bess, and she, I guess she recommended that he does a column which he sends around to some people who follow his stuff. And and mm-hmm. began sending it to us. And frankly, we're an investigative news site primarily, so religion
right.
is not really up our alley exactly.
Right.
But I must say that because of the nature of some of the news relating to class of civilizations and with religion playing such an important part in our politics these days, I began to sort of think, well, maybe we should sort of reach out a bit. And Reverend Bess is a former Baptist minister, and he is I really didn't know that much about the Baptist religion, how diverse it was. You think of it in certain ways, perhaps as being sort of a hardline Christian religion, but you know, it was founded by Roger Williams when he escaped Massachusetts to found the Plymouth Plantation of Rhode Island. And so it's always been part of that idea of separation of church and state, where people are allowed to, should have freedom to express their religious views and debate mm-hmm. them, but without that getting mucked up by the government. So that's a big strain in the Baptist faith, and I was not fully aware of that, I guess, even though I grew up in New England and should have been. So what's interesting about Reverend Bess and his work, I think, is that he takes a look at the Bible from a sort of historical perspective and does serious mm-hmm. analysis of what the divergent points are in it and how that led to Jesus's religious beliefs and what happened to the early days of Christianity, following it through from the views of Jesus as an outsider. And I just hadn't thought of this either particularly, even though I grew up as a Congregationalist. But that Jesus was sort of this, essentially a sort of a social radical, and that like when on Palm Sunday when he rides in on a donkey, he's essentially mocking these fancy religious leaders in Jerusalem. He came from the sticks basically, and
right,
he was
right.
part of this sort of rural movement that basically saw the center of power, whether the Roman governors or the leaders of the temple in Jerusalem, as oppressors almost, people who were demanding money and putting them down. So Jesus reflects this view of these poor people, and he's essentially very much a more radical character than I think is sort of portrayed these days. And a very interesting piece that Reverend Bess did around Easter was where he said, he went through and said, oh, there are all these ceremonies for different parts of Holy Week, but one part that gets ignored or doesn't get mm-hmm. the treatment it deserves is going into the temple and knocking over the money tables.
That really appealed to the socialist. I read that piece, and listeners, you've got to go through because it really is overlooked that he went in, and I forgot that part of my Methodist, early Methodist upbringing. I've since become an agnostic, but I've got a big soft spot for this kind of interpretation of Christianity, and Reverend Bess pointed that out, and I forgot about that. That was one of Christ's last acts before he got
it sort of explains why he was targeted this way. He was very much trying to disrupt what he saw as a very corrupt both the official religion in Jerusalem and of course the Roman power over the people of Palestine. So Reverend Bess, and then he also will deal with issues like how Christianity got off course from what Jesus had taught, from we know from the Sermon on the Mount and so forth, to what how it was it began to be implemented, partly because Apostle Paul had a very different take on this. He wasn't even aware, apparently, of many of Jesus' teachings, since the Sermon on the Mount had not been committed to writing for a number of decades. So there are different branches of how what Jesus was teaching was not even what the early Christian faith in certain ways was promoting. But then further, of course, when you get to the 4th century and the early Christian church is basically absorbed by the Roman Empire, and it becomes part of the power structure, and then things really go awry. So I think it's interesting to sort of look at this through the eyes of someone like Reverend Bess. And, you know, I read that sometimes his columns are pretty religious, and we don't really run those if they're pretty much just that. But if they have some historical perspective and sometimes sort of current commentary, I try to work with them and see what we can do in terms of getting useful and interesting stories at the website.
It is, Mr. Perry. I want to let you know, Kansas readers would appreciate Reverend Bess much more. I think even Governor Brownback, I dare to say, and I'm not being using this as a stretch of the imagination, he could definitely use Governor Brownback could definitely use Reverend Howard Bess at Consortium News. Now, let's move into another writer. Now, this guy, I like him, and I think he used to be associated with another writer. These are all insiders at Consortium News, folks. And Mr. Perry's in the middle of a fundraiser, and you've got to consider, you really got to consider some donations to him. But I want to go to another writer that I think is associated with this guy on PBS who quit PBS or was retiring, Michael Winship. Winship?
Right.
Yeah, who's this? Tell us about him.
Well, I mean, I don't. He was a writer for Bill Moyer's show.
That's it.
And
right,
he
right.
is. And he does a column that he sends around to a number of places, including ours. And he writes about issues that are often money and politics related. You know, for instance, he recently had a piece about examining how some of the new Tea Party members of Congress are behaving just like all the old members of Congress have, you know, lining up at the trough of the lobbyists to get their PAC money and get paid off, in effect. So, you know, an interesting piece. He pulled together a number of items that dealt with this topic, and he's a very gifted writer. He's a little more flowery than some of our writers, I would say. but the main point we try to make is that I want all our stories to be interesting and informative, and sometimes. Yes, so I think we will tend to be sort of newsy in our approach, but if someone's able to pull it off and tell a good story with a more anecdotal kind of lead-in, and I think readers like that change of pace.
As long as there's good substance to it. It is, Mr. Perry. It's a grill. By the way, our listeners, that Michael Winship's article is "Tea Partiers Run to the Big Money Trough." Which, if you were listening to the first half hour of the show, we had Jim Hightower, who is doing a two-minute version of it. But Mr. Winship gets into it a little more detail, and it's there at Consortium News. Now, there's another writer. Now, this guy, a little more, I think he's more in your vein of investigative journalism, Lawrence Davidson. And I'd like to know who he is, because I think I'm confusing him with a guy who I think was formerly in the Bush White House, working for Colin Powell, but
different guy. No, that's
different guy. Help me out, because I follow him too on Consortium News. Lawrence Davidson.
No, Lawrence Davidson is a professor, and he also sends his stuff around a bit to different places. But I think he likes it going to us too, because you know, I'll go through and I will sort of edit a bit and the. But he's a professor who writes a great deal about the Middle East and about mm-hmm. some of the he's fairly critical of some of the policies that Likud is following in Israel. He's pretty scholarly and follows it very closely.
Yes, he does.
And I think there are times, you know, I always look for stories that. You know, where I'll say, "Gee, I didn't know that." You know, or that where someone's got some information that I had not looked at in that kind of detail. Maybe I might have, you know, seen something quickly reading through some newspaper. But some of the stories that I like best are the ones that provide both a solid analysis, but with a lot of good, interesting facts that are not that apparent to people. David will do a lot from drawing from the Israeli press, for instance, which he follows very closely as part of, his academic work. So that can be very useful. And he's pretty skillful in how he presents the information.
I've been dying to ask you these questions as an editor, and I'm a podunk country curmudgeon of an editor on Fight and Cock Flyer in terms of picking out stories, and I was interested in hearing. We've got two more writers, and then I want to give you we'll talk about some of your more recent stuff and what's going on in Consortium News, but both of these guys have appeared on Radio Free Kansas for short interviews, but I consider Consortium News a real mainstay, listeners, for people to regularly check, because you're really going to get it's not going to be thrown at you like from an ideological bent. There's actually a lot of good stuff that backs up facts, that back up what each of Robert Perry's writers he selects to back up. And that's one of the things, that a discerning eye, I think, that is given rather than just throwing up whoever gets there, as God knows or whoever knows. I do at the Flyer. I see something that just gets me going, and I'll throw it up there. If it stirs up the readers in Kansas, who I think need stirred up, all my conservative readers comment about it, and they can't believe I get away with it and not get arrested. But Bob Perry, Bob Perry, Robert Perry brings up stuff on Consortium News where it's almost damn hard to refute it. I mean, two guys, both been on Radio Free Kansas. I'd like you to comment a little bit about each of them, if you would. Kevin Zeese and Danny Schechter. I just love Danny Schechter, the news dissector, and Kevin Zeese. Could you tell us a little bit about it? Because I see them regularly.
Well, Kevin Zeese is somewhat of an activist, good news reporting on behalf of his activism. Particularly, he's done a good deal on the Bradley Manning case, and so that's been that's been useful too, because we've as a journalistic outlet, we obviously are concerned about the ability of the American people to get information, and the work of the alleged efforts by Manning to leak this material to WikiLeaks, and then its publication in drips and drabs there. It has been an important window that the American people have gotten into how their government has actually been functioning. When I have, from personal experience as a journalist here, there's so much that is over-classified in Washington. There are legitimate secrets, and I think one wants to respect that. But what I have seen over and over and over again is the government classifying material out of some hypersensitivity for some people's feelings, or because it's embarrassing, or for reasons that don't really relate to anything around national security. And they can always find a reason. They can always find a reason to do that. And some of the documents, when we first started Consortium News back in 1995, one of the reasons was I had gotten hold of a cache of documents, some of which were highly classified, relating to some historical events in the 1980s. And these were, but nothing really in them should have been secret. They were things that the American people really should have known, that people historically, to understand our history, needed to know. And so we started this website, consortiumnews.com, and as a way to initially get those documents out, we put them up on the website and we did stories about them. And this has been a recurring thing that the way the U.S. government works is that so much is hidden from us. Now, so in that sense, obviously we're concerned when a news outlet like WikiLeaks comes under attack, or when people who provide information as whistleblowers come under attack, i.e. Manning, or allegedly what he's done. So you have this. So one of the reasons that I've been using some of Kevin Zeese's work is that he has covered that pretty closely and, for instance, had published a long, essentially an affidavit that Manning had produced himself regarding how he was treated what he was, you know, the what his daily life was like, and it was pretty wretched at Quantico. And here he is, not even convicted of anything. He's an accused defendant. But his what he did was not, assuming he's even if he did it, it was to help the American people get information that he felt was important to them. Anyway, so that's Kevin Zeese.
Danny Schechter.
Oh, and Danny Schechter, of course. I've known of Danny Schechter and sort of known him personally for a number of years. He's one of these older journalists who was around. I remember him in the early 1970s when I was living in Boston, and he was on this radio station, which was then kind of a really kind of hip, smart station, WBCN, and he had his show, Danny Schechter, the News Dissector, and it was really a smart, intelligent news show. Dealing with issues of the day, a lot of them relating to the war in Vietnam or some of the disclosures around abuses by the FBI. And he did some brilliant work, and he was somewhat of a media critic as well as a journalist. Sadly, BCN went off in one of those corporate directions and became rather useless as any kind of a news place. But Danny moved on and held jobs at some of the networks. He was involved with CNN, I think ABC. But
yeah,
like so many of us, sort of these serious journalists of the old school who really pursued information in a tough-minded way, we were gradually weeded out. We were sort of pushed aside. And partly because they wanted the people with the better haircuts and that sort of thing, or they wanted people who would toe the line in a political way better, in a way that wasn't going to rile up the Reagan administration or rile up George H.W. Bush or rile up anybody. So a lot of us got sort of pushed aside, but Danny is a person who sort of stuck at it. He now writes mostly about economic matters. He's done a fairly recent documentary on the Wall Street crisis, where he's been pushing for it to be seen as a crime, not simply a set of well-meaning mistakes.
Excuse me, Mr. Perry. You know, one of the things I saw about that I noticed early on is that Inside Job gets an Oscar, an Academy Award. And listeners, if you check out Danny Schechter, go through Consortium News. But there's his documentary, Plunder Crime of Our Time, is every bit as, in my opinion, it doesn't have all the flash and special effects of Inside Job, but it has just as much information, actually, if not more. And this is one of the things I've discovered about Bob Perry's Consortium News. He digs around. He finds good writers that have their substance, real meat to their stories. You just can't go to your, you know, there are too many liberals in the Kansas Democratic Party today who, listeners, this is to you. There are too many liberals in the Kansas Democratic Party today who tend to avoid conflict. And we're not talking fisticuffs. That's the tough stuff out here in North Jefferson County. That's what you got to do your politics out here. You got to be tough and you got to carry guns. But most of you people in Lawrence, Kansas City, Emporia, Topeka, my listeners, I know you're there. You send me emails. And you want you like Bob Perry, and you and this is a time to consider supporting him. But this is the kind of why you've got to look at Consortium News beyond Counterpunch. You've got to really look at Consortium News as something that it goes into the meat, the marrow, the bone marrow, the marrow down inside the bone. And what makes Consortium News? You're going to get facts and good writers, and that's why I just can't emphasize enough to my Kansas and Midwest listeners to check it out and regularly bookmark Consortium News and use it, because it really has great stuff. Danny Schechter is a real gem. I was watching people going on about the Inside Job getting the Oscar for a documentary, and I thought, my God, Danny Schechter's produced one of that. And I learned of Danny Schechter through your website. Bob. No kidding.
I didn't know that. Danny's also been, of course, he's had a website too, but he, but like a lot of us, he's had trouble, you know, raising money for it. And he's, but he's one of those real, he's a treasure that the United States should appreciate a lot more than it does. He's an excellent journalist and a very smart guy. And I think also, by the way, I think Counterpunch does some excellent work, and I'll cite some of their work from time to time as it cross paths with ours. So there are some interesting, well thought through areas of journalism, outlets for journalism that are there, and they're free, and we sort of rely on donations. I think pretty much all of us. But it's something that if you can't donate, you can still read the stuff. We don't cut people off like the New York Times starts doing. And I think these are often people who have had a real experience in journalism. These aren't just folks who are doing this as because they just sort of want to, or because it becomes a way to spend their free time. Many of the people we're talking about are people who worked for major news organizations, and because of the problems that the American media has had, the trivialization as well as the politicization of it, a lot of people just either left in disgust or were pushed out. And so some of these places serve as really crucial outlets for their information, their work, their craft, to be shared again with the American people. And so I think that's the sort of thing Americans should look for. People often ask me, well, you know, it's so terrible with the news. What can we do? And I think it is hard. But I do think there are some places where people really are still trying to not just shout their views, but really present information in journalism as it used to be. As you know, what I always say is, ConsortiumNews.com is really the kind of stories that you used to see on the front page of the New York Times in a different era. And now, you know, we try to provide that as best we can through this different, more modern outlet, the Internet. We've been doing it for 15 years. And there are times that I think it's like really some important things that we've been able to establish, both current news and historical information. And so we try to reprise some of these things. So if people missed them the first time around, we'll get back at them a different way. We have sections for we have a From the Archive series for people, stories we've done over the 15 years that might have relevance today. The other day I put up in the context of Libya, now that there's this new policy of kind of using a shock and awe approach to the Libyan conflict, I put up a piece that veteran ABC news war correspondent Don North did for us.
I'm just getting ready to bring up Don North as well. And I noticed there's a deal for donors to Consortium News. And I've got to be honest, I haven't shucked the bucks to find that out. Don North goes back to the Iran-Contra or the Central America stuff.
Don North was literally one of the journalists on his belly outside the U.S. Embassy in Saigon during the Tet Offensive.
Oh, was there with
the Marines as they were trying to retake the American Embassy, which had been partly overrun by this attack by the Viet Cong. So Don has, you know, been in every war zone you can imagine, and he has an incredible insight into how wars are fought and how journalism covers those wars. And he also did work in Central America, you're right. He did work for Newsweek, one of the publications I worked for. But like a lot of us, he was not he maybe stepped on some toes here or there and ended up sort of being sort of more or less working on his own. And so when he was in the late 90s, he was interested in going to Kosovo and Serbia, where there was a conflict brewing. And we had some of the earliest stuff about the Kosovo conflict, and it was so Don's reporting was so balanced. I mean, he showed how basically all sides were doing pretty horrible things. He wasn't just shoveling the propaganda, which often happens when the United States kind of picks a villain, decides so-and-so's the villain, and the other side has to wear the white hats. Sometimes the side with the we put the white hats on don't deserve them, frankly, and often things are murkier than the Washington Press Corps likes to present them. And I think we're seeing something similar to that in Libya, where I'm not sure there are any white hats either. But if you look at the case in Serbia, Don did this really brilliant piece about the attack where NATO intentionally attacked Serbian television. They bombed the television stations, and their argument is, well, oh, they were presenting propaganda, and propaganda supports the Milosevic regime, therefore it's fair game. Even though it was a civilian target, the people inside were defenseless. But it was decided that was something that could be done. And in a way, the war in Serbia in 1999 was essentially the dry run for shock and awe. People don't remember this perhaps, but what happened in Serbia was the NATO, instead of trying to defend the Kosovars, who were being attacked by the Serbs, the decision was to attack Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, and to so damage Belgrade and disrupt phones and electricity and water and so forth, that the people of Serbia would then get rid of Milosevic. And essentially the same thinking was then applied in 2003, 4 years later, to Iraq, with the idea that, well, we'll blow up some buildings and we'll make things really miserable for the folks in Baghdad, and they'll rise up and get rid of Saddam Hussein,
mm-hmm.
or maybe his generals will kill him or something like that. So then we did that. Of course, it didn't work so well in Iraq because the Iraqi army was not so easily shaken, and ultimately, of course, the Americans right after that went in there with the invasion, and then the insurgency followed, and so forth. But we're seeing some of those same patterns now being begun in Libya, and there were actually some comments I found in a New York Times article, sort of buried deep in them, from the U.S. military officials sort of describing their thinking. And what they were saying is, we're going to do to Tripoli what we did to Belgrade. That is, use these kinds of attacks on the civilian infrastructure to make life unpleasant for the Libyans, so unpleasant that they'll supposedly rise up and get rid of Gaddafi. So, but having this sort of historical context and what it really means, you know, what this tough guy rhetoric actually translates into. The hundreds of civilians who were killed in the attacks on Belgrade were actually cited later by an Israeli official saying, well, you know, you guys killed something like 4-1 civilians over military people in Serbia. How can you criticize us for our attacks on Lebanon or Gaza, where the ratio was less,
right,
civilians to military? So There are consequences by these actions, but I think it's important for readers to understand the nuances and the complexities, and that's we try to present that in as fun, interesting a way as possible.
Well, it's certainly Serbia was done under Bill Clinton.
That was under Clinton, right? And General Wesley Clark was, of course, in charge of the NATO forces, and he has defended this. This was a willful attack. This wasn't an accident. It wasn't like a bomb went astray and hit Serbian television. And there actually had been some private warnings to some American correspondents to avoid doing, because Americans were using the facilities there, as were British and other foreign correspondents, were using those facilities to transmit their reports back to their home stations. So this was, but essentially they put a lot of people at risk, including Western correspondents, in order to shut down what they considered a propaganda outlet, which also, but that also raises questions, which Don gets into, is to what is a propaganda outfit? You know, he sort of says, yeah, yes, there were parts of what they, what the Serb TV was doing was propaganda, but it was also presenting some legitimate news, real news, like some of the casualties that were being inflicted in Belgrade were first being reported by this station. And Don says, well, you know, what about CNN? You know, sometimes CNN or places, American stations can have their own propagandistic elements. They present things that often which turn out not to be true, as we learned during the Iraq War. So it's a very slippery slope when you start killing journalists or trying to destroy TV stations and such because you don't really like the content. And we've seen something also similar with Al Jazeera, where the Bush administration targeted them, and there was just that story this past week about how they, how the Bush administration locked up an Al Jazeera journalist for 6 years at Guantanamo, basically because they were trying to find out from him how Al Jazeera worked. They wanted dirt about Al Jazeera, which they thought was too favorable to the Islamists. But you get into this problem of where the U.S. government is picking and choosing what is legitimate news and what isn't, even as the U.S. government itself is in the business of spreading propaganda through American news outlets. It puts everybody in play, in effect. It crosses a line. You know, if it's okay for the U.S. to kill Al Jazeera journalists or journalists for Serb TV, where's the moral basis to say that it's not okay for someone else to kill American journalists? So it has a very dangerous consequence. And Don, I think, addresses it very, very intelligently in his piece.
Well, you know, also leading into a little bit, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this. You know, we have a Kansan who is in the Army or maybe in the National Guards. His name's Ethan McCord. And he's from Wichita, and he is the medic seen hauling, grabbing the two little girls out of the van that was shot, where I think two Reuters news people were killed, and it was released from WikiLeaks it was a video called Collateral Murder, and he was a medic, and he was pulling them away. And he didn't make any big headlines in Kansas. Our editors, publishers, and our conservative news media listeners did not showcase this guy. But he is a Kansan, and Ethan McCord's his name, out of Wichita, and he was the one, the medic, that drugged those two little girls, wounded, bleeding, out of the van that was shot by a rocket, I believe, from a U.S. helicopter after they slaughtered, and I believe, weren't there some Reuters reporters that were killed in that same thing?
Right. There was an attack. It was during the surge period in Baghdad in 2007, and basically what we now know is that during that period, even more so than before, a lot of the gloves came off. The Bush administration was rather desperate. General Petraeus was desperate to salvage his position, so there was an unleashing of an awful lot of even by standards of Iraq extra violence on targets. And this was a case where there were a number of men walking down the street. There had been a conflict not that far away earlier. There was no hostility being shown toward the American helicopters, but the helicopters, I judged that there was some, that these folks were insurgents or militants or something, and opened fire and blasted them quite badly with rockets. And then there were two Reuters news people in the group, and one of them was crawling away, and a van came by to sort of help him get into the van to sort of take him to a hospital. Uh-huh. And the American helicopters then attacked the van, claiming that it was coming to the aid of militants, and in the van there were these two children, and the two children were badly wounded, and your medic was really kind of was a hero going in there, and and saving the children's lives. Sadly, however, I think their father or the adults that were with them were also killed. It was one of the documents allegedly leaked by Manning that relating to this video that was put out.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was part of the alleged package, vast or archive of material that Manning supposedly allegedly gave to WikiLeaks. So it was, but what it really gave a sense of was the on the ground reality, and not just in some report of or some news story. This was something people could watch, and it's pretty horrifying.
Yes, it is. See
how this life and death struggle was being played out in the name of the American people. So. That was one of those very troubling things, and I think the American soldiers that were able to rescue some of the people who survived deserve a lot of credit too.
Well, you know, Ethan McCord, I've paid attention to. There was very little coverage in Kansas about him. Very, 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 very. I mean, he didn't make it. There was no headlines. There was nothing about it. And I had to dig around, strangely enough, and found elsewhere where some reporter actually, and he's not, it's not like this guy is, he really doesn't want to talk to people, you know, about this. But what he has said, he said at the time, immediately after Mathen, when he was discharged, he has said that all I could think about, and this is a quote, all I could think about was my two little girls in Kansas. When he was carrying those two little girls out of that van. And I came to Collateral Murder. Listeners, that is available on YouTube. Just Google. You know how to Google. Google Collateral Murder YouTube, and it'll take you right to it. It hasn't been taken down. And Julian Assange went through, I guess, a little bit of stuff about decoding the actual video. This is video shot from the helicopter, and I find it extremely illuminating for many Kansans if they would watch that to realize that there was a Kansas boy just like your son and daughter down there on the ground rescuing these two little girls. Their father was killed, slaughtered. The van, it was so shot up I couldn't even believe that the two little girls lived. And here's a Kansas boy, a native son, taking these two little girls out, and he's saying, and it's not covered in our local media. It was not covered in our local media, Bob.
Well, that's the biggest problem. And I think it's probably the reason we have consortium news. It is, and I came out of AP and Newsweek.
And by the way, I want to interrupt you once. I want to interrupt you to give you. I want to tell you something. I learned about Collateral Murder through Ray McGovern's article there at Consortium News. He embedded it. Go ahead.
Right. We did run that. We had the video at the website too. Yeah.
Yes.
But that's sort of the reason we exist, really, in my view, is that there are so many times that things are actually well documented, but they get downplayed or ignored, and other things that are not nearly as important or are propagandistic get pushed and made into the leads of these stories. There's been a loss of judgment because the U.S. news media has undergone the same kinds of pressures in some ways as the folks at the CIA analytical division did. It was understood by the time we get through to post Watergate period that information was an important battleground, and to control that battleground was crucial for people that wanted to control the American people and to influence them in ways that they wanted to. So journalists became sort of fair play, as did the CIA analysts. It was, you know, can you destroy this person's credibility? Can you make them, put them under such pressure they can't do their jobs? And then if stories still are pushed through, can you pressure the editors to not play them up very much? Can you kind of bury them or discredit them? That became the way things were done when you get through the 80s and 90s and through the last decade. So the whole point of Consortium News is to sometimes set back and say, listen, there might have been some brief reference to something somewhere, but here's the full story. And one of the examples that I use, one of the best examples of this, occurred at the end of 2008. There was a release from the LBJ Library of audio tapes of President Johnson talking to different leaders in 1968, at the time when he was trying to bring the Vietnam War to an end. And I'd always, having grown up during that period, I'd always kind of thought that LBJ was really not trying to bring the war to an end. I thought he was kind of, he said that, but I thought it was one of those things politicians said. But what's remarkable about these audio tapes is that he was actually very sincere about it. And the war was almost being brought to an end in as we get to the election time in 1968. And according to these are audio tapes. You cannot get better evidence than this.
This is the President
of the United States talking with various people about what he knows based on intercepts that he's had and intelligence that he has access to. And at one point, he's talking to Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican, the Senate Minority Leader at the time, and he's telling Ev Dirksen that Nixon is who is of course running for president in '68. Is trying to sabotage the Paris peace talks by getting.
Wait a minute, back up, because this is history, ancient history for my young listeners, and I have a lot of young, working class Republican listeners, and I'm always chiding them to disaffect themselves. But you're saying in 1968, Johnson's talking on a tape recorder in the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm.
In the White House,
and there are half a million Americans.
It sounds like you're saying he's fretting about Nixon getting elected, and you're saying he seriously knows that the Vietnam War is going to spin out of control.
At this point, there are half a million American soldiers in Vietnam, and Johnson has decided not to run for re-election because he says this is back in even earlier in the year he's going to work on ending the war. Then you get to, so he's almost at that point. He's almost got the war ended in October of 68. But he learns, Johnson learns that Nixon has secretly been trying to sabotage the peace talks because Nixon doesn't want the war to end. Because if the war ends, then Nixon thinks that Vice President Humphrey, who's the Democratic nominee, will be elected and Nixon will lose again. So Johnson is telling Senator Dirksen, a Republican, that Nixon is committing treason, and he tells him that he explains what Nixon's doing. That Nixon's gone to the South Vietnamese government and offered them a better deal if they boycott the peace talks. Nixon says that he'll give then President Tu of South Vietnam a better deal than Johnson would give him. So he's trying to undercut the foreign policy of President Johnson and essentially extend the war in Vietnam. Now Johnson learns of this, and we know for other pieces of this from other sources. But so Johnson uses the word treason, and there's a brief story that appears. The AP runs a story which sort of mentions that Johnson thought Nixon was committing treason, and the New York Times runs the AP story. Johnson thought Nixon was committing treason, and I was expecting, frankly, that the next day there would be this huge long story explaining the historical context. And I open up my New York Times the next day, and there's nothing. So I go back on my own and listen to all these tapes, and I go back, and there's actually more interesting stuff. There's actually a conversation between where Johnson confronts Nixon and basically lays out what he thinks Nixon's up to, and Nixon sort of denies it, but it's all very – he sounds like he's lying. There's another point when Johnson has now got even more confirmation right before the election, and he's discussing whether he should go public. He talks to Defense Secretary Clifford, and Clifford says, and Clifford sort of discourages him, says, "Don't, you've got to keep this secret, because what if we put this out and Nixon won anyway, that would not be good for the country. Clifford says. So Johnson agrees to go to keep it secret. So Nixon succeeds in stopping the peace talks. There's more conversations between Johnson and Nixon after the election, but at that point Nixon is now, he's cut a deal with the South Vietnamese. He has to sort of show the South Vietnamese that he's going to do what he can to win the war for them. So the war goes on for another 4 years. Another 20-some thousand American soldiers die. You know, the death toll in Indochina is extraordinary. But this, so I went back and I did this long story describing not only these audio tapes, but also what we had known, because pieces of this had come out over time. Cyrus wrote a little bit about this in The Price of Power, his book in 83. There were some documents that came out that Dan Shore got hold of, you know, some years later. So there were pieces of this that had come out, and so it was not. So there's a real context here of how. But this is a remarkable story of how politicians will sell out the American people, even 500,000 American troops in harm's way, to gain power. Yet, as remarkable as that story is, even though it was historical, this is in 2008, it would have been sort of an historical piece, but there was no interest in telling that story at the New York Times, the Washington Post, any of them. So we did this long piece at Consortium News. But I'm sure a lot more people would have read it if the New York Times had done it. But still, that's the point. And you're talking about it in the Kansas context, that there are stories that you'd say, of course that's a news story, that some brave young Kansan took part in this and had this reaction to this carnage. But if say you're an editor and you sympathize with George Bush's war in Iraq, you might say, I'm not going to write that story. I'm going to put that on the back page. And essentially, we're seeing that across the board. The New York Times made that decision relating to these documents or the Johnson tapes. It wasn't that they didn't know they existed, because they'd run the AP story, which had a brief reference to them. They just chose not to deal with it. And I think part of the thinking is what Clifford said. And I ran into this, especially at Newsweek. There was a sense of this sort of noblesse oblige attitude of, well, we know what's best for the American people. They really shouldn't know certain things. If they know certain things, that they might get upset.
Really say that. I mean, I've never been in those kind of high honor sphere. They actually I've worked at a little county newspapers, and we've sat around and bullshitted and joked, listeners, I'm telling you straight up, it's like you get a press release from a politician, and if you need filler, you just type it in. This is in the 1990s. And 1990s, it was accepted practice to just reprint the press release, and I had to argue with people, and these are my little country weeklies who I dearly love. I know editors are in a crossfire. If you piss off the town banker, you lose $75 a week, and that can hurt you. You lose a grocery store ad, you know, that can hurt you. And you just reprint the press releases. And that was what the state of journalism was in 1991 through 1995 when I ran Country Weeklies, and I knew it was wrong. And I just could not, you know, I worked as an apprentice in the room drawing up these papers and typing them, and literally typing them in and bitching and complaining to the publisher saying, this isn't right, you know, we should do a news piece, we should do a countervailing opinion on organic farming versus the local chemical company we would run press releases for our advertisers, you know, and they would, and we'd print it and we'd type it in and make it look like real news. And it wasn't news. It was just something that was churned out by some PR outfit from the agrochemical industry to support the local co-op ad. And that's a bare-bone, bare-toothed fact about journalism in Kansas. And that's just on the Country Weekly basis. It goes all the way to the top, folks, in our daily papers. There's something to it. And I think Bob Perry's talking about that. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Bob, but God damn it, brother. It really hits me in the heart, man. You know, it really does.
It hits me too. I grew up in a newspaper family. My dad ran a newspaper in Massachusetts and in Framingham, Massachusetts. And one summer I was working as a he'd make me work each summer as in some part of the newspaper. And I was working as a reporter, and he said, "Okay, Bob, you can write any story you want, but just don't write anything that's going to make Shopper's World look bad." So, you know, and he was pretty frank about it. That's the name of the game. And
they are.
At the national level, like when I was at Newsweek, and I was, which is part of the Washington Post company, well, at least it was then. There was a different attitude. It wasn't as much advertisers, although that might influence some. There was this sense that they were almost part of the ruling elite, and they thought it was their job to kind of guide the American people rather than to inform them. And there was kind of that sort of snobbish attitude. And I came out of AP, which was more of a working man's kind of news outfit, more straightforward. And so I clashed with some of these attitudes where the thinking was, well, Henry Kissinger has just told me that, you know, they'd all move in those circles where they thought that they'd consult with Colin Powell and get, you know, and they thought that they were always getting, and much of they even cared that these guys were lying to them. It was that they were important and powerful, and so that meant that the Newsweek editors must be important and powerful. And they all kind of rubbed shoulders. It was an incestuous relationship that was operating at those levels, and I'm not saying that money and ads didn't relate to it. Newsweek had its share of McDonnell Douglas ads and so forth, but it was also this idea that those in power knew best, and the American people were there to be guided. That the idea of just informing them, giving them the nasty truth, was not really the job of Newsweek. And not that there weren't times when Newsweek did do its job reasonably well. But a lot of times it was viewed as, we don't want to go down that road. It will just cause trouble. And that's why they hated the Iran-Contra scandal, which I was working on. There was a lot of hostility at top levels because it made the whole ruling elite look very corrupt and bad and undercut what they saw as foreign policy that they backed. They thought the U.S. should be more aggressive internationally at that point. And so the idea that we were writing about how many ugly corners that existed, how many dark corners there were in these operations, was not welcome. So Don North ran across the same thing, by the way, when he covered a massacre that occurred in El Salvador, which is what he has this DVD out that you mentioned earlier that we offer at our website. But he was covering that for Newsweek, and the U.S. Embassy was quite angry because he described this massacre that had occurred committed by the Salvadoran military against some rural area that was considered sympathetic to the guerrillas. And so the U.S. Embassy complained, the State Department complained, and essentially the Newsweek did not want to back up Don very much. That's how it really went. And so a lot of journalists realized that they were risking their careers if they upset people too much. And they didn't, so many of them stopped doing their jobs. Others, like some of us, have tried to figure out new ways to do our jobs. But
you have.
Anyway. So.
The DVD, it's a DVD that Don North offers through your site, doesn't it?
Right. We're offering it as you can better get it. I think he has it selling on Amazon. It's called Yesterday's Enemies. I think it's in there if you want to go to Amazon. But we offer it as if someone sets up a $10 a month donation at Consortium News, we'll provide it as a thank you gift. It's actually a very interesting documentary. It has some of that old footage that Don took when he was working at for Newsweek. But it also updates it with what a lot of these people are doing now. He sort of went back there to find the survivors in this area. And, some have become part of the new government. Some have, some feel that things are no better today than they were then. I mean, it's very interesting.
That's amazing. I'm surprised any of them are still alive, frankly, but that's great. So the DVD actually has an update to it. Huh?
Right. The DVD includes both some of the historical material and where some of the people are today, yes.
And you're asking for $10 a month for that. That's as a gift. And that's. And by the way, another thing I noticed about your website, you have a 501c, is that the correct terminology?
Right.
It's a nonprofit,
yeah.
Or something.
It's a nonprofit. Right? You know, so the donations are tax deductible or can be tax deductible.
And then one other question I want to throw at you. This is all gossip, consortium news gossip for my part. I actually have some other ones too. Questions too. And Kansans, listen, you all know gossip is 90% of figuring out a lead on a good news story. Your sons are involved, and they helped you set up this website originally. Nat, and who's the other one? Sam.
Sam. Well, they're not really as involved today as they had been in the past, but. But actually, when we started Consortium News back in,
right.
it was Sam's idea. It was because I was sitting there with all these documents and no one seemed to really want them because they were relating to historical stuff from the 1980s and who cared by 1995. So I was grousing about this and Sam who just finished college is my oldest, and he said, Dad, you know, there's this thing called the internet. You know, you could set up something. They call them websites. And I said, really? I didn't know. And I'd heard about the internet back then. It was kind of pretty early in those days. And so Sam, who was no techie by any means, he was, but he sort of figured out
good.
How to.
He must be pretty good.
Well, he figured out how to set up put together a website. And
he did a good job, Bob. I'm going to interrupt you. I want to tell you, listeners, this isn't like now, Bob, Mr. Perry. Just bear with me, all right?
Okay.
Listeners, that's for you liberals who avoid conflict, okay, out here in Kansas. You're constantly avoiding conflict. You're in the Kansas Democratic Party. You're worried. Now you're worried because the Republican plutocrats have moved in. You've learned that some of your Democrats are plutocrats themselves. And now you go to Mother Jones. You go to End These Times. You go to these big-shot left-wing websites, and you get all these, excuse me, Mr. Perry, goddamn pop-ups. You get all these pop-ups and banners, and they bomb you. You don't get that at Consortium News. Consortium News takes you right to the website. You can get your select your articles and go right to it. I don't know who designed your website, Bob, but I'll tell you right now, it's clean, it's mean, and you go right to this stuff, and I like that.
We are about to revamp it. Although we're going to keep it'll keep those features, but we have gotten a little bit behind the times in terms of some of the technology. So actually, Sam has sort of reemerged in this, and he said, Dad, you've got to switch to there are better platforms to use now, and. So I think in the next week or so, even the look may change a bit, but it'll have the same. It'll still be the same idea, which will be we want people to be able to see the stories easily, go to them. You know, I'm as frustrated as anybody when you have to sit there and watch some big ad sort of unfold on your computer while you twiddle your thumbs. You know,
right.
So we try to make it as straightforward as possible. We will have some more technological changes in that.
That's
right now,
cool.
Right now, since we've sort of had a piece, right now our it's still a little homemade-ish kind of
sure.
operation, and so certain things some people say people have trouble with, like some of the linking to not to the stories, but if they want to like Facebook something, or if they want to move send things like that. So our new system we hope will address some of those concerns that people have raised, and it'll also have a nice clean look. The new design is going to be actually very probably cleaner and just a little spiffier than what it is today. But anyway, we're going to keep the same approach that we don't want to bug people with all that stuff.
That stuff is annoying as hell, and I will tell you. When I see a lot of these left-wing places I go to, it's annoying to hell when you get the drop-down. Mother, You know, I love Mother Jones, and I love Counterpunch. Well, to his credit, Alexander Coburn doesn't give you anything like that. But you are right. There, since the advent of the Arab Awakening, so-called Arab Awakening, I consider this sort of the 1848 for the Arab countries, widespread peasant revolutions. I've learned the value of Twittering. I think, what is it called? Twittering.
I'm not even sure. I guess you tweet.
My wife.
But it's called Twitter.
Yeah, well, I've been starting to do that, and I've been really And my son is saying he's teasing me, but I haven't learned Twittering until just the Arab uprisings, and it's a really valuable thing. And if I have any input on your son's head, you need to put buttons on there so you get an article and you just automatically tweet it or tweeter it and send it to people, because that's a great feature. That and Facebook are the two big things. And now I'm not going to cut you off. As a matter of fact, I want to go into the deep part of your most recent work. Do you have time, Mr. Perry?
Yeah, I have a little more time.
Let's talk about the birther movement and Donald Trump. Yeah, your most recent article, which I was just overjoyed to read about, because you really take apart the history of this, disinformation campaign. And you put it in a historical context. I forgot about a lot of this stuff, about the stuff they've done to President Obama. Could you help me out on this? This is great stuff.
Well, obviously there's been, since Obama sort of came onto the scene, there have been attacks on his Americanism, if you will.
I'm guilty of it a little bit as a lefty socialist libertarian. I'm guilty of this. And I read your piece yesterday, and I looked at it again this morning in preparation for the show today, and I thought, my God, there's a lot of truth to that. This guy, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, no, I think he has been attacked in this way, not just by Republicans, but by some of his Democratic rivals before that. And if you remember, there was a point before the Pennsylvania primary when Hillary Clinton was still in the race, that there was a nationally televised debate which ABC sponsored, and I think it was Gibson was one of the moderators, and he began pressing Obama on why he wasn't wearing an American flag lapel pin.
Right, I remember that.
And what was sort of curious to me at the time was that neither Gibson nor George Stephanopoulos, I think was the other moderator, neither of them were wearing American flag lapel pins. Hillary Clinton wasn't wearing an American flag lapel pin. And for that matter, Republican then nominee in waiting, John McCain, he didn't wear one either. But it was only that they expected this black guy with a funny name to sort of prove his Americanism by putting on a flag lapel pin. And Gibson's explanation was, there's been a lot of talk on the internet questioning your patriotism. And which I'm sure is true, but then there's a lot of stuff on the internet relating to a whole bunch of things that you don't need to ask people about. So Obama was being in that debate and in other cases was sort of pummeled over these kinds of issues, and he always responded with a lot of equanimity. He didn't really get his back up. He did, though, if you remember, after he got pummeled, he did get pummeled in the primary too in Pennsylvania. Hillary beat him by double digits. And after that, he started wearing his flag lapel pin, like they wanted him to. And he still does to this day. If you see him, he's always got his flag lapel pin on. So once that was sort of, I guess, taken care of, that he would wear his flag lapel pin, there are other questions were raised, including these ridiculous questions about where he was born. And this is an interesting conspiracy theory because, conspiracy theories usually have a little bit that they can base themselves on, and the facts are not usually so compelling the opposite way.
Right.
In this case, you had
the birth.
The state of Hawaii, having issued a birth certificate, a short form birth certificate, which is used for people proving citizenship everywhere. So if you're Hawaiian, and it's similar, what happens? You know, if I asked for my birth certificate from Connecticut, they would send me this little thing, not the whole thing. Anyway, so there was that. There were, of course, the birth announcements in the papers in 1961, and so there really wasn't any evidence here, and the evidence was quite compelling, clear, unequivocal the other way, and the notion of this conspiracy was that. I guess their idea was that that Obama's mother had been in Kenya for some reason when she gave birth, and that then she smuggled the baby out of Kenya.
Well, flew him
to Hawaii.
I could tell you this is exactly what I received literally hundreds of emails from Kansans. They're all forwarded emails. And none of them write anything, and I always email back, and I reply to all on Google, because it's a good, nice thing about Gmail is that you can have hundreds of people who have forwarded email, and then one person, one of my contacts, sends it to me, and I just click reply to all, and it goes back to hundreds of people who sent the email and forwarded it onto. I mean, they're very stupid. You know, they just forward it, and they don't care about their email, the confidentiality of their email list of the people that they got it from. So I did this routinely for quite a while during the Obama campaign when they were sending this. Really, this is the birther stuff. It was that and other stuff, half-breed, Muslim, all kinds of derogatory stuff. And I keep wondering, I've always wanted to ask Ray McGovern, is this a disinformation campaign from some disgruntled reactionary conservative CIA people who joined the McCain-Sarah Palin ticket, you know? Because they're so cleverly worded, and there's no sources cited, no embedded links to take you to nothing. It's just horrible attacks on the Democrat of the day, but in this case it was Obama. And that's where I first learned of birthers, was as far back as 2008. And I'm just amazed at how many Kansans would just forward these emails to me. And I would, you know, email back and reply to all and says, like, you know, who are you, what's your source? Why do you do that?
That was
a long time ago, and it's enveloped into Donald Trump. Of all people,
right.
I think
the only evidence that anyone's ever cited to me, is, and this is not real evidence, but there was an interview through a translator to one of Obama's aunts or something in Kenya, and there was, and the question was, were you present at his birth? And the person, the elderly woman, said, yes, I was. Presumably meaning I was alive at the time. And then the next question was, well, where in Kenya was he born? And the woman responded, no, he was born in Hawaii. But if you cut out just the misunderstanding of what the word present referred to, that became sort of the core of this conspiracy theory. But it was ludicrous. I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous. And the idea that the Dunham family, which was not exactly a powerhouse, these weren't the Bushes. If it were the Bushes, maybe you could see them bullying some people and bribing some people, and because they might expect actually to have one of their offspring become president one day. But the Dunhams were just lower middle class family living in Hawaii. The mother was 18 years old. The idea that she could have gotten this baby past U.S. immigration, and then somehow gotten the hospital and the state of Hawaii to go along with this falsification of records and get people to sign their names to it, is so stupid and beyond belief. It to say it defies credulity is like an understatement. But it also tells you, though, how effective the right-wing propaganda machine is. And this is another big deal we talk about at Consortium News a lot. It's just to understand what the right did
going out of the 70s through the 80s and the 90s in building this machinery where they can put almost any crazy idea out there and have at least a third of the American people buy into it.
Well,
and it almost
do.
Doesn't matter how crazy it is. It's extraordinary
out here in Kansas. It's extraordinary for you more settled minds who are capable, who have the time and are calm enough to analyze the situation. But I almost heartily assure you, those emails were floating around in early 2008, before Obama was elected. It was the biggest shock in the world. And I remember I was reading your article, rereading it today, about Obama and his Americanism being questioned. And I was reading it, and I thought, I forgot how wonderful the support was and how inspired I was to see all these, you know, even in Kansas City, Missouri. You described going to a rally with your son, I think it was in Virginia, and the amount of sharpshooters that were around the play. It was the same thing in Kansas City, Missouri, around the Liberty Memorial, when a huge crowd showed up for President Obama, at that time candidate Obama. And I my friends would email me saying, you've got to straighten these people out where you live. Out here, I live like 50 miles away from that, and they're saying, you know, this is sweeping the country. President Obama, black African American, being elected first in the presidency, and my friends there in Kansas City, Missouri, telling me, you need to work harder, Mike, at spreading the word that the country is changing, and these are all overwhelming young people, and I was at the same time on the same days. Getting these horrible emails from grandmothers, 80-year-old grandmothers, and people out here in the country who were forwarding these horrible disinformation things about him, his citizenship. And the most recent, I must tell you, my roosters are crowing. The most recent was just a few days ago. Now they've said that he wasn't born in Kenya. He was born in Indonesia, and they airlifted him into Hawaii and got him in there in time somehow to forge or document these his citizenship. it's just non-ending the doubt, and I'm trying to think, is it? What do you think? I mean, you think we should I should move to New Jersey or somewhere? I mean, I've got to stay here, but I mean, I'm broke and I can't go anywhere. But I mean, really, Mr. Perry, it's a recalcitrant blend out here in terms of people who just will not give up.
Well, I think what it says is that this is not really about anything rational anymore. There's obviously no sense of empiricism.
Uh-huh.
The whole idea of bringing Indonesia into this, yes, it's true that Obama's mother married an Indonesian, but that was long after he was born. And so I don't know why Indonesia would be a factor here. She went to Indonesia in connection with second marriage. So there isn't really anything. I mean, I suppose you can spend a lot of time, and I must say there are also some conspiracy theories on the left that have squandered a lot of my time, that where people seem to think that what they want to do is get at somebody. You understand why they want to get at the person. They don't like them for some reason, but that still doesn't justify making up lies and disinforming the American people to confuse them and get them riled up. This is what is in the intelligence world is called agitprop. It's called black propaganda, where you go in, and I think one thing we've seen, and as the information age has moved ahead, is that things that were sort of more associated with intelligence operations in hostile states, we might have done in Chile, for instance, during Allende, or done in against Mossadegh in Iran in the 50s, or things of that sort, have now blown back into the American political system. And so people who are – I'm not saying they're in the CIA now, but they are using CIA-style techniques to set up to get people angry, to rile them up. It's agitprop, and so you spread falsehoods. And if you have a machinery, which the right really does, which is very willing, and in fact is almost dependent on spreading this kind of stuff, many of the radio talk shows that are all over the country, the Fox News, you name it. They've got magazines, newspapers, books. They got the whole nine yards. And they can then put these things into play, and then they can repeat them, and they reverberate, because the guy that writes the book about how Obama doesn't have a birth certificate, you know, Corsi goes on, you know, Fox News, or he's interviewed by one of the big radio talk show guys. And so suddenly Americans are hearing all this stuff from all these different directions, and that's what in the early phases of this, when the British were doing this kind of propaganda intelligence operation, the British called it the giant Wurlitzer, and the Wurlitzer
really?
The organ, and that was this was a concept that the British had, where you would play all these different notes. And they'd reverberate through the giant organ, and people would hear all this, and they would ultimately come to believe it. And so this was it was called the Mighty Wurlitzer, and it was this idea that you could essentially use propaganda to drive even a fairly well-educated population in certain directions. And now that's sort of become commonplace now in America, because we're so inundated with media that, you know, where one side has invested so heavily in ideological media, and frankly the progressives haven't done much of anything on this, but the right certainly has. And so you have this imbalance where, you know, as I say, almost any crazy thing you want to put into play on the right can get put into play, and you will have polls some months later showing one-third of the American people believing it. And I think the birther episode is revealing not only in the racial component, because there's no question that this has a racial undertone, but it's also interesting in the concept of the ability to put out something that is so patently untrue, and to get a lot of people to buy into it. It's an extraordinary moment from that point of view, and not a very encouraging one, I should say. But it's extraordinary.
Well, I hope you consider coming back on. We'll address the birther movement as it unfolds. And thank you, Mr. Perry, for coming on Radio Free Kansas. We're running out of time, brother.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Bye bye.